So today's event is co-organized and co-sponsored by Secret Center for Asian Studies and also East Asian Languages and Literatures. Before we begin, just a little bit of background information for those of you who perhaps attend our event for the first time. So our event today is this year's first event for the King Reynold East Asian Humanities Lecture Series. Our sincere appreciation goes to two very special guests who are always here to support us, and they are here today. Professor Emeritus Young-Hee Kim Reynold and Mr. Bertrand Reynold.
Could you please stand up
a little bit so that people know who we are? So their generous endowment enabled EAIL to create this platform for discussions on topics in the field of East Asian humanities. It is my great pleasure to introduce and also welcome back our alumnus and also our distinguished speaker today, Dr. Richard Penn. Dr. Penn received his PhD in East Asian art history from Columbia University, and his BA in Chinese Language and Literature, and MA in Chinese Literature with a minor in Japanese Literature were both obtained from here, GW. He's currently Director and Curator of Asian Art for the McLean Collection outside Chicago. He has also worked for the Japan Society and Asia Society Museum in New York as curator. He's the author of many books, so I'll just mention the recent three publications. Cartographic Traditions in East Asian Maps, published in 2015 by University of Hawaii Press. Chinese Swords, An Ancient Tradition and Modern Training by Media Publishing in 2017. He's also the author of the novel The Chinese Jar, published in 2016. Today he'll be talking about early modern cartographic traditions of China, Korea, and Japan. So before we begin, I would like to remind you that there should be no food and drink consumed here in this room, okay? But we do have a light reception available outside, so I would like to invite you all to join us for the light reception after the talk. So let's welcome Dr. Richard Peck.
The podium is going to block me for a moment, so I'll use this. So today I thought, atypically, before I get into the lecture, is to talk a little bit about my career path. This is where it all started. 1981, Jonathan Chaves had been here for 2 years. And actually, I came here as a transfer student in my junior year. I had been doing astrophysics at another institution, and
people are like, what's the connection? I'm like, well, you know, Chinese philosophy, cosmology, it's all linked together. That wasn't my master plan at the time. I don't think I necessarily had a master plan, but I knew I wanted to learn Chinese literature and philosophy and study that. And a professor at Ohio Wesleyan, where I was studying, said, well, there's this young guy at GW, Jonathan Chaves, he's this up-and-coming superstar, and you should go and study with him. And 3 months later, here I was. So talking to some of the people who are teaching here now, my program, everyone scratches their head and says, that was possible, you could do that. And even when I was here, the Chinese literature, language literature major switched between colleges each year I was here. So I was at Columbia College 1 year, and then I'd go to get signatures long before you could do anything online. You had to get, every professor had to sign, and you had to go to the dean's office and get a signature. And so I would go to the dean's office, and they'd say, that's not in this. You're over in the School of Public and International Affairs. That doesn't exist anymore either. So they'd send me to another place, and the next year I'd go over there, and they'd say, no, you're in Columbia College. And the next year I'd go, so my major was one that no one really knew what to do with. I just kept taking classes. After I did my BA, I lived in Asia for 2 years. I lived in Taiwan, and I wasn't part of a formal program, but I studied at Taida as an adjunct, University of Hong Kong. Lived in Indonesia for 8 or 9 months, and then came back to do an MA here with Jonathan. And at that time, I said, well, can I do Japanese literature as well? And the department said, sure, why not? That's how it worked. You would go to Shi Zhongwen, who was the head of the department, and she'd say, you and Jonathan do whatever. And I would, you know, I'd go in the course catalog, and it would say Yuan drama. And I'd go to Shi Zhongwen, drama is her thing. And she'd say, I don't teach that class. Where is that? Where does it say that? And so she would say, go figure it out with Jonathan. And so the two of us. So my whole master's program was classes of me and Jonathan. And everyone's like, that must have been so fantastic. Yes, I had, you know, this brilliant translator, and it was just the two of us. But I was the only student. And it's a classlet where you're translating classical Chinese. So mine is the only translation. There's no one else to discuss it with. There's no one to study with. There's no one to do anything with. It's just me and him. And he's just sitting behind his desk. It was just in his office. Sitting behind his desk. And you know that you could pick up any Chinese text and he could just translate it, la-di-da. And I'm sweating every class before. And I would have classes back-to-back with him. There was one semester where I had 4 classes in a row with him. And he said, where do you go in between the class? I said, I go out and just stand outside. I just want to get out of this building. It was all in this building. Stand outside, come back. And he said, I don't know if I should be insulted. I said, that has nothing to do with you. I said, you know, you want me fresh for each class. So I go out and I come back. So in any case, my whole sort of program of study here was outside of and peripheral. And this has been really a story of my career, always on the periphery. Charting new courses, I guess. But my very first job in 1989 was working in the Asian Art Department at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Might as well start at the top. Knew nothing about Asian art. I had a friend, some of you may be familiar with, another art historian, Stephen Little. He's out at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, as a curator out there. He had taken me into storage to look at paintings, Chinese paintings, at the Met, like in 1987. He's about 7 years older than I was. He said, just come. And so my then girlfriend at the time, I subsequently married her 29 years ago, said to me, don't you know someone? And the New York Times had a listing, administrative assistant, Asian Art Department, Metropolitan Museum of Art. I thought, great, sure, I'll apply. And I went in and met with Frieda Merck and James Watt, people who some of you may have heard of, be familiar with some of their work. They interviewed me, and I said, well, how do you go from administrative to curatorial? And they said, you don't. I said, well, how did you guys get your jobs? You know, I was in my 20s, and it was all new to me. And the next day, Frida called me and said, you know, you're way overqualified for an administrative job. This was, anyone could have applied for it. It was just answering the phone and filing and doing simple sort of front office things. She said, however, because you can read Chinese, Japanese, French, and English, we have a project where we need a research assistant. And so because of the language skills and the literary skills that I had acquired here, they hired me. I had zero training in art history, but that was the beginning of my museum career. I worked at the Met for 2 years. I then worked at Asia Society for 5 years. Then I applied to Columbia, and because I'd worked in museums in Asian art departments, still no art history training per se, but I had taken, Asia Society had a staff development fund for employees to take classes. Now, typically at that time, this is early 90s, the idea was that you would be learning some kind of software or some cataloging system or something that would be applicable to your job. I took art history classes at Columbia. And so the result of the degrees I got here, and everybody knows Japan in the field. Whatever field you are in East Asia, everyone knows Japan. So I had a recommendation from him. I had worked in various places and had started taking courses and did an East Asian major. So I took my focus was painting. So I had the great good fortune, Murase Sensei, Miyako Murase was still teaching there. David Sensaba was teaching there. So I was taking classes on Chinese painting, Japanese painting, and one course on Korean painting and calligraphy, in Korean art, that sort of was divided up between various professors. And then I became, in the midst of writing my dissertation, I worked at Japan Society for a year as the curator there. I was hired for a very specific project that looked at East Asian art history. It was Cross Currents, Masterpieces of East Asian Art in New York Private Collections. And the director hired me, she had just started, specifically because I was familiar with Chinese, Japanese, and Korean art. So once that project finished, I said, I'm in the middle of my dissertation, I need to finish that. I left, finished it, became a kind of scholar for hire, taught at NYU and SUNY Purchase, and worked for museums that have Asian collections, but not full-time Asian staff. So, and there are quite a few of them in this country. And so was sort of a scholar for hire. And then Barry McLean, the fellow I work for now, found me and hired me 14 years ago. And I've been there since. And I was hired to run, it's a purpose-built Asian art museum, private Asian art museum, just on the North Shore of Chicago. And so I was hired to install it. So I was given a 15,000 square foot building that was empty, brand new, and a 40,000 square foot warehouse full of stuff in crates that he had been buying for the previous 30 years. So it took 2 years to, and you're all welcome. You should all come. You should go to McLeanCollection.com, look it up, come and see us. It took about 5 years to install the building. We started publications. We just came out with our sixth book, one of which is the Cartographic Traditions of East Asian Maps. And about 4 years ago, in order to create a long-term plan, the Map Library, which is a separate institution, they're about a mile apart, we decided to join the two, and I became director for both. And as a result of moving that into a new space, it'll all tie back together. The map curator kept bringing me maps that he couldn't read what they said, but he knew they were in the database and they needed to get located in the new space. They were Chinese, Japanese, and Korean maps. And so, piqued my curiosity. I'm a museum person by training. That means I'm object-driven. So when you become a museum curator, you become a specialist. And granted, my degree is in painting, but the building I run, the H&R Museum, doesn't have a single painting in it. It's got early bronzes, early pottery, architectural fragments, Southeast Asian material. You become a specialist of what you have to work with. And so, right about that time, publication, an art history publication, Orientations, was doing an East Asian issue. And they said, oh, we'd love for you to do an article on East Asian maps. And I said, that sounds like a great idea. And so I started to look for source material on East Asian maps. There are lots of books on Chinese maps and Chinese mapping and Korean maps and mapping and Japanese maps and mapping. But there's not a single book in any language except for mine that looks at the region overall. And what became interesting and apparent to me is that, for example, Chinese cartographers and those writing about Chinese cartography are very much only thinking about Chinese cartography. And so there are things about Chinese cartography that are unique to China. But there are some things that are found in all three countries, nation states. But because they're only looking at Chinese maps, they're not necessarily, there are some things that they just assume, make assumptions about, but don't realize that that's one of the things, one of the characteristics that distinguishes it from a Korean version made at the same time, mapping the same kinds of information. And so it became very apparent to me that somebody should do the book. And so this is the reason that 3 years ago, took about 5 years of research, that I did this book. As a result, I am the guy, again, when I started 35 years ago, here, not my master plan, to become the world's expert on East Asian maps. It's not to say I'm the Chinese maps guy, or the Japanese, or the Korean maps guy, I'm the East Asian maps guy. Which means, in many circumstances, I'm the non-Western maps guy. And so I spend, I don't know, I probably give 10 to 15 lectures worldwide. I have in the next, this is a really busy time of year for me. So I'll be in Manila on a Wednesday talking about Chinese maps, historical Chinese maps of the Philippines. The next day I'll be in Hong Kong talking to an arts historical group about Ricci maps and their influence over the course of 300 years in all of East Asia. And the day after that I'll be talking about route maps, historical route maps in the China Seas, looking at Red Seal ships and the Red Seal routes, and that's the Shuinzhou. So Japanese groups will understand, this is from 1600 to 1634, all international trade, if you wanted to trade in or out of Japan, you needed a license. And so they were issued, and about 400 plus of them, and the routes that they went to, we have quite a bit of historical information. And so the other part of the lecture is talking about actually tribute routes, maritime tribute routes, and it turns out that the ships that they were using are hybrid ships, Chinese-built junks that use Western technologies that were created. The very first one I have found textual evidence. There is a book that was written in, I'm wandering off, but that's the nature. They said talk about anything you like. There is a book written in 1756 by the 21st envoy who went from Beijing to Ryukyu, to Naha. Every time a new king was appointed in Ryukyu, an embassy was sent from Beijing through the Grand Canal and by land to Fuzhou, and then from Fuzhou to Naha. And the ship that was built in 1534, that was commissioned in 1533, is a combination of Chinese and Western technologies. And it's from textual evidence from the 21st envoy in 1756, who recorded all of the previous envoys' records and published it under one book. Depending on what language you want to read it in, it's the Liu Chou Guo Leo.
Now I forgot what it is.
Leo. And in Japanese, Ryugoku Shoku. No, I can't remember what the other character is. But in any case, all of that leading back to giving you an idea that the path, my particular path, has taken me to this place of East Asian maps. So that's my introduction.
Thank you all. So I'll shut that off. Stick it here. So today what I want to talk about is... come on. Exactly what I've introduced. So most of the material that we'll look at today are things that are in our collection, the McLean Collection Map Library. You want to get the screen? Yeah. I don't know if we can... Don't pay any attention to the person behind me. Right. The Great Oz is here. So much of what I'll talk about today is, and the head of the department, originally we were going to time this to work with coursework on, I can't remember if it was a Japanese literature class or geography class that you had talked about, and we were going to do it in the spring, and then it got changed to the fall, and it went to... East Asian, fine, but historical, but also talking about the introduction of the West into cartography. So this is a little bit of lots of different things that I currently am currently doing research on, some of which I've published, some of is waiting to be published. That process is infinitely complicated. As you all know, sometimes it takes a year, sometimes the book that was for the Festschrift that was done for Jonathan was begun 10 years ago, and it came out last year. And I wrote my essay like 9 years ago, and I completely forgot. And no one ever asked me about the images that I used and getting permission for them. And I said, well, it's online. We can all see it. And actually, I talked about poetry and painting. A very famous poet. Painter Wang Mian, who's also a martial artist. So the other part of my life I didn't talk about is that I started the martial arts just about the same time I started this program, and it's something I practice still every day. The swords book is two of my articles, one talking about historical swords and the other talking about calligraphy and sword masters of the Tang Dynasty, which I published about 20 years ago. So one of the most obvious differences and distinctions for East Asian maps in comparison to Western maps and map-making traditions is the use of text and image. Quite obviously, this is a map I was telling Jonathan yesterday I've made famous. I refer to it as Big Blue for obvious reasons. This is a large format map that was first created. It's a reprint of a map from 1767. The previous year, this is when Qianlong has finally created a relationship in every direction. Xinjiang is first created in 1756. And that region with the Ilai peoples and the ethnic minorities that were there was the last. Over the course of the previous 120 years, starting with his great-grandfather, you had obviously Manchuria was not a problem, but Mongolia was divided into upper, lower, eastern, western. That was negotiated. You had all of Central Asia. All of these kingdoms were negotiated. Tibet became its own autonomous region. Vietnam, a relationship was established, and so Xinjiang was the last piece. And so to commemorate that, the last of the 10 Western journeys for the emperor, was a map was created. This map is a reproduction. The information provided is based on the 1767 map. 1800, it gets expanded. And so the original is actually only about a meter square. The 1800 version expands it a little wider, and there's a little more information. And then you get up to this one, which is the map itself is not dated, but subsequent copies of it. We have one in our collection from 1882, dates it, and gives us a specific year when this map came out. So I'm often asked, in particular with this map, and you see I wrote Chinese map characteristics. And so when we, this is fantastic, because I didn't actually read it when we reformatted it, and so I see that it goes monochrome, shapes vary, administrative map. What is the information that's provided here? So quite often Westerners say, why isn't the map more accurate? This is the beginning of the 18th century. The Jesuits have been, the huge Jesuit Atlas Project is already 100 years old. So all of China has been laid out and mapped from a Western perspective. Why doesn't this map look Western? And the answer is that it's not trying to be Western. It's not interested in the same kinds of information that Western map making is. And what do I mean by that? The easiest example is those of you who have looked at any East Asian painting and consider it from a Western perspective. When a Westerner looks at it, they expect a certain kind of play, a trick of the eye to create two dimensions, to create three-dimensional space. So you have a single point perspective or two-point perspective, you have a receding ground plane, things in the foreground are big, middle ground medium, far ground small. But when you look at a Chinese painting or a Japanese or Korean painting, a hand scroll for example, the trees can be the same scale at the top, in the middle, and at the bottom. So this idea of space that recedes, it's not that the Chinese don't understand it or East Asians don't understand it, it's just not of interest. I think it's because they understand that it's two dimensions. And so they're not attempting to create three-dimensional space in two dimensions. It's about brushwork, it's about composition, it's about all of those things that when you talk about and look at literati painting China, Japan, Korea, that kind of information. It's not about recreating an actual space. Wen Fong's famous book, Images of the Mind. These are not artists who are standing out al fresco and looking at a space and copying exactly what they see. They go out to that space and they go back in the studio and they create paintings. And so that same kind of difference in terms of what you want to the information to convey, the visual information, is the difference that you see. And so my point here is that this is an extremely accurate map. And the reason is, and so this is, here I'll go back just to show you what you're looking at. This cartouche here, and then I've just pulled up a detail arbitrarily, this detail here. So the cartouche gives you information about how grand and wonderful the Qing Empire is. And then you have a little key here. And you see different shapes. So here's a square with a small rectangle on top. Here's a square. Here's a rectangle with a triangle, a rectangle, a diamond, an oval, etc. When you start to look at the map, you see that all of these shapes are different. So here, where's our capital? Here we are. So here we are, Shanxi, the capital, Taiyuan, here. You've got ovals, rectangles, a square with a triangle. All of those shapes are represented here. So what you're looking at is an administrative map. And so right here, in a single image, you have the entire administrative system of Qing China. This will tell you, as an administrator, your tax base, your communication system,